Good morning. The first reading is from Psalm 145, starting at verse 1 to verse 9. I will exalt you, my God, the King. I will praise your name forever and ever. Every day I will praise you and extol your name forever and ever. Great is the Lord and most worthy of praise. His greatness no one can fathom. One generation commends your works to another. They tell of your mighty acts. They speak of the glorious splendour of your majesty, and I will meditate on your wonderful works. They tell of the power of your awesome works, and I will proclaim your great deeds. They celebrate your abundant goodness and joyfully sing to your righteousness. The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love. The Lord is good to all. He has compassion on all he has made. The second reading is from Romans, starting at chapter 13, verse 11, continuing on to chapter 14, verse 4. And do this, understanding the present time. The hour has already come for you to wake up from your slumber, because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over. The day is almost here. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armour of light. Let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy. Rather, clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ, and do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh. Accept the one whose faith is weak, without quarrelling over disputable matters. One person's faith allows them to eat anything, but another whose faith is weak eats only vegetables. The one who eats everything must not treat with contempt the one who does not. And the one who does not eat everything must not judge the one who does, for God has accepted them. Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To their own master, servants stand or fall, and they will stand, for the Lord is able to make them stand.
Morning, everyone. This is unusual for me to have to preach the same thing twice. I hope those of you who've been here the first time don't mind that.
You get a chance to get it right this time.
All right. Can I begin by saying what a joy it is to be here and pay tribute to Andrew? I've known him for years, because you were in Lancaster for a while when I was at St. Thomas's, and the quality of his ministry is so obvious, and I'm glad to be here in the Free Methodist Church. I'm sorry, I'm struggling with a sore throat and a cold, so I can't really bellow like Andrew does, or so it'll be fairly quiet if that's okay. I'm an unreconstructed petrol head. All of my life, since long before I was able to, I've been able to drive or ride. I've been passionate about motorbikes and classic cars. I've had, apart from short periods of time in my life when our children were small and I couldn't afford it, I've had motorbikes. And now I've got a classic car, and some competition. Yeah. I heard a story some time ago about a man who liked to restore motorbikes, particularly Harley Davidsons. Do you know? I guess you know what a Harley Davidson is, don't you? It's an American motorbike. And he heard, he lived in Ireland, he heard about this 50s Harley that was for sale, but needed restoration. So he rang up, went to see it, saw it, bought it, and took it home. And if you're into restoring old vehicles, you need to really get all the bits together before you start. And so he rang the local Harley dealer in Ireland and said, I've got this Harley. He gave them the year and model, and I need a whole, he gave a whole list of parts that he needed. So the Harley dealer said, well, in order for us to do it properly, we need the engine number and the chassis number. So if you could send that to us or just give it over the phone, we'll process your order. So he did that, gave them engine and chassis number, and left it with them. And a couple of days later, they rang him and said, look, we're sorry, we just haven't got all of these bits that you need. You'll have to go to Milwaukee, in the USA, where the Harley was born. So he did that. He rang them and said, exactly the same, I've got this model, I want to restore it. Can you give me all of these parts? And they said, give me the chassis number and the engine number, and we'll see what we can do. 2 hours later, someone rang him from Milwaukee and said, I know this is an unusual request, but will you take the saddle off your motorbike and look under it? And he did that, and there was a brass plaque riveted to the frame, which said, a gift from James Dean to Elvis Presley. So what he'd paid a couple of £100 for suddenly became priceless. I've longed for that to happen to me all the way. When I was a vicar visiting, and some dear old lady saying, well, look, vicar, we've got this Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost in the garage, which we don't know what to do with. Would you like it? It's never happened, but I haven't given up hope. So if you've got some classic around that you don't know what to do with, I can help. A few years ago, there was a book written by a wonderful Jesuit priest called The God of Surprises, Henry Nouwen. And thrilled me about that book was this Roman priest was telling us all to be aware that God loves to interrupt our lives and surprise us with his generosity, his love, and his grace. And that was something that I think I needed, and probably all of us need. So the guy who bought that old motorbike certainly had a surprise. I don't know whether he thanked God for it, but the illustration is sound. God wants to interrupt your life and surprise you with his generosity and grace. The season of Advent, Andrew's already mentioned that we're in the season of Advent. Advent, which is a preparation for Christmas. I have one regret about this time, that we move too quickly to Christmas. Certainly in the Anglican Church and Roman Church, as far as I'm aware, Advent is a season in itself, rather like Lent. We go through Lent and then we celebrate Easter. We need to go through Advent and then celebrate Christmas. Of course, many of us started to celebrate Christmas according to the big shops round about August, didn't we? With all of the pressure on us to buy things. But I wonder if this season of Advent between now and Christmas is a time when we could put ourselves into the hands of God so that he can surprise us. Are you able to spend time in quiet in your prayers rather than, speaking all of the time? Are you able to just sit and listen, be in the presence of God, and enable him to surprise us with what he wants to say, what he wants to do. So I'm praying that for me and for all of us, Advent will be a time when we are surprised by the grace and beauty and glory, forgiveness and gratitude of God. In that sense, it will be a time of transformation. Transformation's a big word for me. Andrew mentioned that I do quite a bit of work in various dioceses in the Northwest. I do most of my bishoping in Liverpool, with a particular responsibility for Wigan. Do you know where Wigan is? And I've got to love the clergy there. There's about 23 or 4 clergy, 33 churches, something like that. And we've got a whole mission called Transforming Wigan. Not transforming the church. I've had enough of church. You know, most bishops get far too much of church throughout their lives. I want to put the church on one side, if I can, and say, let's look at the community. We need to transform the community. And we managed to get £1.25 million from church commissioners to start employing people to make a difference. So we employed someone we've called the director of Transforming Wigan. And the local authority are really enthusiastic about it. We've got an office in the investment centre. We've got, the town councillors backing it, thrilled by it. We're appointing chaplains in all of the high schools and colleges, and we haven't had any objection whatever. The community around us longs to be transformed and wants us to get off our church high horse and get into the community. I'm probably taking coals to Newcastle, but you will know all about this and are doing it already. But I'm speaking as a poor Anglican, and we need yet to get the whole church mobilized. But great things are happening. God is surprising us. I had 2 days away earlier this week with the clergy and pioneer ministers from Wigan. Went to Rydal Hall just for a time of retreat. And the atmosphere there is electric. Anglican clergy longing for Jesus to do something new. Longing for this period of Advent to be a time when we are surprised by his power and his love. Longing to be made more and more into the likeness of Jesus. Transformed ourselves in order to bring transformation to others. And when I look at the church, I want to say to the whole church, you included, if you are not a place where people are transformed, you're nothing. I get into trouble when I say this in cathedrals, but I will continue to say it. If people are not being transformed by coming into this place, then we've missed the whole point of being church. Michael Ramsay, a former Archbishop of Canterbury, said, "The church is not a thing in itself to be passed on from one generation to another, as though that's all we do. And God help us, I've heard clergy say, you know, as long as I can keep the church more or less intact and pass it on as I picked it up, then I'm happy." And I want to tear my... Well, I've torn a lot of hair out. And I want to say, you know, you've missed the point. It's not it. Michael Ramsay said, and I agree wholeheartedly with him, some of our archbishops said some brilliant things. You perhaps know that. He said, the church is to be an experience of the resurrection. In other words, as people come and meet with us, wherever they meet with us, here or outside, they need to experience people who've been transformed, who've experienced the resurrection, who've been raised to new life. Otherwise, they can't have hope. It'll just be like joining another club, a religious club. But they must see that Jesus Christ can change lives. We know it theoretically, we know it theologically. Many of us perhaps know it practically. The point about it is, Preston, Fulwood, Lancashire, the UK, needs to be transformed. And the only power I'm aware of that can do that is the power of Jesus Christ. So Advent is a period of preparation for his coming, when we look not only to celebrate his birth, but to celebrate his return. We know that that's going to happen. And so it could be a period when we quietly, genuinely find times to get alone with God and allow him to speak with us. I've learned the last, I've been a Christian for over 50 years, I think, something like that. But I've learned to say less and less in my prayers. I don't need to tell God everything that's going on. What I do need to do is sit in his presence and hear the eternal word. There's an icon, Rublev's icon, the Hospitality of Abraham. Do you know it? It's perhaps a silly question. You weren't new. You probably don't use icons here, do you? Well, I didn't at one stage, but this is the figures of the Trinity sitting around a table, the holy table, inviting people to come and sit with them. And I often use that as an image for my own prayers, seeing myself sitting in the presence of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Trinity, not blabbering on about things that he knows all about, but listening. And once we hear God about the things that are on our hearts, we can speak with precision. Not just rehearsing some of these endless Christian cliches that we've all learned. Speaking in the silence, listening in the silence, is perhaps a way we can learn this Advent. As I say, I may be teaching my grandmothers and fathers to suck eggs. If that's the case, I'm sorry. But it's such an important message, it seems to me. Let this Advent be a period of transformation, where the God of surprises can actually come in and speak to us words of hope and of healing. Never condemnation. There's no condemnation. God does not condemn us. A lot of us are frightened to listen to him because we think he's going to drop a brick on our head because of something we've done wrong. I've met one of my neighbors as an atheist, and I asked him why. And it was his childhood. You know, parents, church, turned him completely and utterly against God. And he said, you know, I just can't believe in a God like that. And I said, well, I don't believe in a God like that either. My God is completely different. He listens to us, but he speaks to us. And he speaks words of wisdom and grace and beauty and power. He's not chasing us. Do you know the poem, The Hound of Heaven, Francis Thompson, where, you know, he likens himself to a hound, likens himself to a fugitive with a hound chasing him and almost catching him. And eventually, the hound catches him. The hound is God, and says, I'm not chasing you to rebuke you or to take things away from you. I'm chasing you to give you all that I have to give. Advent could be like that. It could be a time when, you know, you grow in ways that you never imagined you could, when you receive from God the gifts and joys that you never thought were possible. And many of us might, even now as I'm speaking, be disqualifying ourselves by saying, well, it would be all right for them, but not for me. Nobody knows what I've done. Nobody knows the things that I've done wrong. And I want to say to you, as a pastor, as a preacher, it really doesn't matter. Another great Anglican bishop, John Taylor, who wrote a book called The Go-Between God, he said, I suddenly realized, this is when he was a bishop, I suddenly realized what the phrase justification by faith meant. And it meant this: no matter how good I am from this moment on, God can never love me any more than he does now. And the scandal is this: no matter how bad I may be from this moment on, he cannot love me any less. That's the bit that we don't get. He cannot love you any less. So any who are here who are disqualifying yourselves because of your past, don't. None of us ever are squeaky clean. None of us could stand in the presence of God and say, as one of the Pharisees did, you know, I do give tithes of all I possess, I'm good and great and wonderful. None of us can do that. All of us can just simply say, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And do you know what? He is. He delights to set us free. It's in my journey as a Christian and as a minister and as a bishop, I've met people who have just loved me into new life. They've been, for me, agents, people of transformation. And what I hope from this service this morning is that we might have a vision of how we can become, you can become, an agent of transformation for others. The first person I want to talk about is a man called Joe, who I met when I was very in my late teens, early 20s, when I'd left school and was training to be an accountant. And he was an accountant, and I wasn't quite a Christian then, but I was beginning to ask all the sorts of questions that people do ask at that kind of age. And Joe was there. He was an ex-Marxist who's had been a member of the Communist Party, and as a member of the Communist Party, he'd been given the New Testament to read and discredit. He was a bright, intelligent man. He read it and believed it. Was transformed. And in the conversations that I had with him, we would read the Bible at lunchtime, and he'd lead me and talk to me about how you can know Jesus. And I'd been going to church for a long time, but nobody had said, you can actually know Jesus Christ. He was an agent of transformation. We've known for decades, for centuries, that the vast majority of people come to faith because of a friend, not because of the church or the buildings or the music or the worship, good though all of those things are. The vast majority come because a friend has said, let me talk to you about Jesus Christ. And a lot of us don't have the confidence to do that, or maybe you do. Well, actually, if you did, this church wouldn't be big enough. But have the confidence. Have the confidence to tell your story of faith. People love to hear it. And that's the way that others are going to be brought to faith. There's no magic about it. There's no great strategy. And the scandal of Christianity is that we're all at the same level. We all, you know, we all need to do it. As one of the northern bishops, I get involved annually with the Archbishop of York's Bishop's Mission to the North. And I took a team from Wigan, young clergy, bright, wonderful, beautiful young people, to Blackpool. And the highlight of that was being in a town centre. We'd persuaded a couple of the local firms to bring out some sofas, and just thankfully it wasn't raining, and put them in a town centre. And you won't approve of this, I know, but Sentamu and me and another bishop, we were in our purple cassocks, just standing there, inviting people to talk. And I met, there was a lady who, she had purple hair, and I went to her and I said, oh, I like your hair. She said, I'm an atheist, you know, you won't convert me. I said, well, I like atheists as well. So eventually she said, can we sit and talk? So we sat and talked. People need to hear us. Not bellowing at them, not, you know, dangling them over the pit, not beating them with the Bible, but telling the story. Joe, the first person I want to tell you about, he did that to me. Still alive, still in contact with me. And he knows. I told him 20 years ago that he'd been a significant figure in my whole experience. There's a great poem by George Herbert. You know, love bade me welcome. Do you know it? Love bade me welcome, but my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew closely to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, ungrateful, you know, and the poem goes on and on and on, disqualifying himself. Then Jesus says, you must come down, you must sit and eat my meat. Sit with me. And I did sit and eat. The encouragement that our faith in Jesus can lead us to the place where we're confident that he's done what he needs to do in our lives. Joe started that process off with me. The next person I want to talk about, are you okay if I go on for a bit? What time do you finish? When I do, okay. Father Peter Dolan, he was the parish priest here at Holy Trinity, Holy Family. And for 35 years, he was my friend, mentor, spiritual companion. He died a few years ago, and I miss him every day. He taught me something more about beauty and grace. He's one of the loveliest men I've ever met. He just exuded love and grace. He'd begin morning service, his Mass, by saying, good morning, beautiful women. Good morning, beautiful men. And, you know, when he died, the place was heaving. The streets were crowded with children from the school as his coffin went past. He was loved because he gave love. He taught me how to expect God to do great things. He called me his bishop. His Roman bishop didn't particularly like that, but he said, you're my bishop. And he called me big brother. And we both learned from St. Seraphim of Zarov, a Russian saint, you know, to use the words, when Peter saw me, he greeted me, my joy. He, you know, a bit like St. Francis. Some of the saints, you know, in the Roman and Orthodox Church have wonderful lives to teach us. That might be heresy, as I know, as far as some of you are concerned. But I don't care. I'm a bishop. I can say what I like. Peter, Father Peter, taught me how to expect God to do great things. Early this morning, I told the story of one of my grandchildren. My wife and I have got four adult children, three boys and a girl, all adults now, all got two consultants in the sort of health industry, two teachers, all with children. Our daughter is divorced and therefore a single mother. She's a consultant psychiatrist and is a wing commander in the RAF, works at Bryce Norton. For years, she worked at Headley Court, which was into rehabilitation and all of that. So my wife is more or less permanently at the moment living in Oxford, sort of caring for the 7-year-old twins. I'm going down next week to bring them all up, and all of our families will get together in Lancaster over Christmas. But these 7-year-old twins are an absolute treat. We've never had twins in our family before, so we, you know, it's a new experience, and we're beginning to learn that it's, you know, there are issues that aren't around with non-twin families. For instance, these two, Raphael and Livia, their names are, they don't need to speak to each other. There's a symbiosis, a sense of connection, which is mysterious, invisible, hidden. And if you're lucky, you can just catch the mischievous glance that goes from one to the other. And then all hell breaks loose, you know. And the dog gets out of the way, the fish go to the bottom of the tank, you know. But they were all up in Lancaster on this occasion, and my wife and daughter were invited out for an evening meal, which meant that I had to do the honours. Brilliant though I may be, there are areas of inexperience that still exist. Dealing with twins is one of them. So it meant that I had to, you know, manage the whole process of feeding them, having a meal, and that can be quite an adventure. Putting them through the bath, make sure they cleaned their teeth, and then we say our prayers and go into bed. And I knew that there was any one of these, you know, different activities could produce mayhem. I mean, I've seen it happen. And, you know, I'm completely lost. I don't know what to do, you know. I decided to bribe them. So I said, if you, you know, cooperate while I make the meal and we have tea together, while you have a bath and you clean your teeth without being told 25 times, and then we get ready for bed and go to bed, and if all of that happens peacefully, I'll give you £1. And Livia, she's long dark hair, big, huge brown eyes, and this ravishingly beautiful smile, just stood in front of me and looked at me, and she said, I'm not a pound sort of girl. Make it 20, she said. Yeah. I suppose at a human level, it quite pleased me, because she knows that she can more or less ask for anything and she'll get it. It irritates my wife and daughter no end. But that's their problem, not mine, as it were. But it illustrates what I'm talking about, Father Peter. He taught me, you can turn your face towards God and ask for heaven. You can ask for anything. You can really and truly expect him to be utterly, utterly generous and gracious. Contrary to all of the stories we've heard about a miserable God, our God is something different. One more person. Are you okay for a bit? You don't have to go anywhere, do you? When I was Bishop of Doncaster, the diocesan missioner used to organize these events, which he called the Bishop at the Bar. And what they would do is hire a pub for the evening, the whole pub, and say to the churches, will you bring your neighbors and your families and your friends along so that, you know, they can meet the bishop and ask any question they want? And all of this in the hope that any question that is asked can be turned towards the sort of conversation we're having now about Jesus. And when I got to the pub, it was packed. Loads of people there. But they were all members of the church, all members of the parochial church council. All of them wanted to nail me because of the money they had to pay to the diocese. And the sort of questions they were asking, I was unable to answer. Because I've always made it my business never to know whether the church coughs up or not. That's not my bag, as it were. So, and they were all, the landlord, who'd hoped to make a killing out of the evening, they were all just drinking water and orange juice, and he and I were drinking as much beer as we could to make it worth his while, and to make sure we got home safely, of course. But after a while, I just simply said, this isn't working, so I'm going to go. I'll leave you to tidy up. And I went to the loo before I left the pub, before I drove home. And you know, I was dressed like this, purple shirt and the silver pectoral cross. As I was coming out, there was a man coming in who looked at me and said, what are you doing here? In South Yorkshire, they're fairly straightforward. Any of you ever lived in South Yorkshire? The most praise you'll ever get is, oh, you'll do. You know? Anyway, this man said, what are you doing here? And I told him, and he said, you come with me. And he took me to another part of the pub where all of his friends were gathered. And as I walked across to that group of people, there was a lady standing closest to me who had her back to me. And as I approached, she turned and saw me. And the first word she said, this shocked me and in a way thrilled me. She said, I'm not a bad person. I've just been so hurt by so many people. Can I hold your cross? So I took it off and put it round her neck. And you know, we had the most extraordinary conversations in that part of the pub. That's why I'd gone there, not to ameliorate the problems that the PCCs have, certainly not to talk about the church. I've had enough of talking about the church. We need to talk about Jesus. And this woman, who I think had been damaged, she was a Mary Magdalene sort of person, needed to know, above all else, that she was acceptable in the presence of God. And this is what thrilled me. Somehow or other, she thought that the presence of a bishop meant, or the presence of any Christian meant, that she was accepted. That was one of the most powerful lessons I think I've learned in my whole life, because it made me aware that, you know, the vast majority of people out there, who was it? Somebody said, I'll just pause for a moment. Yeah, it's okay. Apparently, it's one of the investitures at Buckingham Palace. It's all right, you can stay in. Just answer it, we'll listen. Yeah. At an investiture in Buckingham Palace, somebody's phone went when the Queen was there, and she looked up and said, you'd better answer it, it could be someone important. She's got an extraordinary sense of humour, the Queen, I have to tell you. What was I talking about before that happened? What? The pub, yeah, the lady. It taught me that most people, heart of hearts, live lives of quiet desperation, longing for someone to touch the very center of their being and say, you are lovely. You are beautiful. You are worth it. Jesus did that, you know, to Mary Magdalene when she came and, you know, washed his feet with her tears and dried them with her hair, an extraordinarily sensuous thing. Poured the most expensive oil she could over him. But what Jesus said is, when all of the others moaned, don't you know what she is? Don't you know who she is? Leave her alone. Leave her alone. What she has done is wonderful. And somehow or other, I think he communicated to her that she was worth it. Father Peter, this lady in the pub, taught me that my ministry, whatever was left to me, was in telling people that they're loved. When I was vicar of St. Thomas's, people came to me and said, will you preach against homosexuality? I said, I'm not going to preach against anyone. I want to bring them to faith and let Jesus in. He deals with those issues. I don't know how you communicate. I'm going to end by telling a story that I like. Do you use social media? Any of you? Yeah. This is an interesting. There's a letter in, probably in the Times or something like that, or the Guardian. The letter was headed, "My Own Social Media." Sir, I haven't got a computer, but I was told about Facebook and Twitter, and I'm trying to make friends outside Facebook and Twitter applying the same principles. Every day I walk down the street and tell passers-by what I've eaten, how I feel, when I went to the lavatory, what I did the night before, and what I'll do for the rest of the day. I give them a picture of my wife, my daughter, my dog, and me gardening and on holiday, spending time by the pool. I also listen to their conversations, tell them that I like them, and give them my opinion on every subject that interests me, whether they are interested or not. And it works. I already have 4 people following me. Two police officers, a social worker, and a psychiatrist. What I want to say is, however you communicate, do it. Church begins at the door, not here. It begins as we go out into the world to tell people the stories of Jesus, to tell about our faith. It begins as we meet people and somehow or other, with our presence, being the presence of Christ on earth, reassuring them that they're lovely. Everything that God made was good. Right. I'll probably leave it there. Just a moment or two of silence.